The subject of karma is a very important one in Buddhism. It's one that can be quite confusing, so much so that the Buddha said that if you it's one of the imponderable, the full range and extent of karma is imponderable. If you try to understand karma to all its different aspects, you'll just get a headache. So what he said is your head will split into seven pieces. Hopefully that's a colloquial way of saying in ancient India that you get a headache. And but I think that the teaching of how the Buddha was, when the Buddha was talking about karma, he was trying to point to something very simple, even though it can be a complex subject. And I'd like to try to point to that simplicity, if I may, if I manage to do that. An analogy for mindfulness practice could be sanding wood. And if you start with wood that's really coarse, then you use coarse grit sandpaper. You use like 50 grit sandpaper or something. And then you sand away until that particular grit has done all the work it's going to do. You're not going to get it any finer. And then you have to change grits. You have to go to 80 or 100 grit sandpaper, and then you can sand it smoother. And then you get to a point where that has done its work. And then you have to go to 150 grit or 200 grit. And then you have to go to that, I don't know what's called, the black stuff, the wet set. Anyway, maybe all you have to do is get a soft rag to do the last little piece of polishing. You started with really coarse wood. And so each grit of sandpaper does a very important work, but then it needs to be discarded. And then you have to do something that's more refined in order to get a polished piece of wood at the end. So mindfulness is kind of like that, or a Buddhist practice, or a meditation practice is kind of like that, where we start with a very coarse wood, usually, ourselves. And especially if we live a busy life, a full life, work, and the kind of urban life that many people live here, it's really hard to sit down and be really quiet and still very quickly. There's a lot of momentum, a lot of agitation often, a lot of feelings, a lot of body sensations and things going on. And so there's a whole bunch of stuff happening. And when there's too much happening in the mind, the mind is going too fast, too many activities, the mind is fragmented, has many different concerns, it can seem that we're the victim of circumstances. We don't really understand why we're feeling so bad or why we're feeling so good or what's happening. We just know that, you know, kind of generally how we might be. And there's a lot of things that might happen to us that we don't really, we blame the world around us for what's happening, or we don't quite understand why we're feeling the way we are, and, you know, there's no good reason for it, and we don't even know what we're thinking. There's a saying that we're so distracted by distractions that we don't even know we're distracted, running around. So to sit down then to meditate in that kind of state, in a very coarse state, then, or just to try to engage in any kind of spiritual practice, we have to start with maybe very coarse sandpaper. And maybe the very coarse sandpaper maybe is not to meditate at all at first. Maybe is to go for a run. Some people maybe need to, you know, just kind of to blow out some of this energy and stuff that's going on. Or some people need to sleep more than they need to meditate. And just the sleeping and kind of helps to kind of settle a degree of exhaustion that goes on. And so the idea is to figure out, you know, what's the coarsest thing needs to be attended to, and then take care of that. And then once maybe the coarse energy is taken care of, then perhaps we could look at things that are a little more refined. We decide, okay, I'm going to sit down to meditate. And meditation, you know, the first things we tend to encounter is the obvious, that which is most coarse. And so we have to kind of deal and work with that. And one of the coarsest things to work with is our relationship with all that coarseness. Our relationship, the way we hold, the way we relate to our, you know, all the energy we have, the speedy mind that we have, the feelings that might be going on. How do we relate to it? Because it's very easy to relate to it in such a way that we just keep stirring up the mind, we keep agitating the mind. If we hate how we're feeling, or we're desperate to try to find another way to feel, or we're trying to push something away, it just stirs up the mind. The analogy for this is that if you want to settle a pond, a muddy pond, you leave it alone. If you take a stick and stir up the pond, that just stirs up the mud and the pond doesn't settle. So how we relate to what we encounter in ourselves when we sit down to meditate is very important. And it's very easy to have some kind of aversion or judgment or some kind of critical way of being with what's here that's not very helpful. It stirs up the water. So maybe the coarsest layer when we sit down is just how we relate to it all. And for some people, that's a big task, is to find out how to just be a little bit more at ease with how they are, not to be critical or judging, and in a sense to accept or be equanimous with what is. To learn not to be in conflict with what is. And then once we can kind of leave ourselves alone, then things begin maybe to settle. Maybe the next coarsest level is the body. And perhaps all the tension, some of the tension in the body begins to unravel, begins to unwind. The shoulders begin to go down, the stomach softens, the hands soften, the face muscles maybe begin to soften. And some of the tensions we've had begin to kind of relax. The paradox, or the irony for some people, is that as the surface muscles begin to relax, sometimes deeper tension that we hold that's invisible reveals itself. And some people feel, oh, it's so great, I'm relaxing. Oh, what's that? You know, suddenly you feel some tremendous knot or pain in the shoulder or the back or someplace. And then people think, well, what happened? I'm going backwards. And actually you're going forwards. It's just that now you've encountered this thing that's been numb for a long time. So as we kind of do the work of getting more refined, more relaxed, we sometimes encounter big knots in our wood and needs particular care and sanding or working with. Sometimes we have to change tools, and the sandpaper is not the right tool. Maybe it's a planer we need, or sometimes we need a jackhammer or something for certain things. And sometimes what it means, though, is that some issues, some things that might encounter and meditate, are not best addressed on the cushion, not best addressed meditating. We become aware of them in meditation, but then we realize we have to go and do something outside of meditation in order to settle it, to resolve it. I mean, some people go to therapy for certain issues. Sometimes what's needed is to go and apologize to someone. Something comes up, something we've done, and it's such a big issue in our psyche that you simply can't continue with the refining work, the sanding work, unless you somehow bring out the big tools and big, tough, strong tools and make that phone call and apologize. Been hard work. and then that particular thing settles, and so then the body settles after a while, and then there's the emotional life, and you become aware of all these different feelings that maybe you didn't even know you had. One of the exercises I sometimes do when I do the intro class in mindfulness, when we talk about mindfulness of emotions, I ask people when they first sit down to meditate to close their eyes, and then immediately, without going to their breath or anything, to tune in to how they're feeling. What their mood is. And almost every time I do that, there's someone in the audience who will say, I didn't have a clue that I was feeling this way. I didn't know. I wasn't paying attention to my feelings. It's a surprise. I didn't realize I was angry. So the encounter with our emotional life is part of what happens as we show up and pay attention. And then there's often a lot of charge in our emotional life. And so as we pay attention and make space for it, and recognize it, there's a refining process that goes on, a settling process that can happen. And sometimes we go through various layers of our emotional life. And then there's also our cognitive life, the life of our thoughts and our beliefs. And as we settle and go through these different layers, we might kind of run head into some layer which is some very strong belief we have, some cherished belief that we're really holding on tight. And there's a whole variety of ones that people are really clinging to, something they really believe, this is how it has to be. And as long as they're clinging to that belief, the sandpaper is going to wear itself out. It's just nothing's going to happen. And you kind of feel the frustration of kind of trying and trying until we kind of look at that belief and then somehow resolve it, work with it, or at least let go of it, clinging to it, if not see through it. And then there can be more and more refinement that goes on. And if a person practices long enough, or practices on retreat, for example, where there's not long enough time to do this in a very thorough way, the mind can get more and more refined. And then there can be tremendous clarity about what's going on. And to give you some sense of that clarity, this is where I'm going to get to the thing about karma, is when the mind is, when the body, when our being is refined enough, settled enough, concentrated, still, and mindful enough of what's going on, you can notice the beginning of a thought. You can be sitting there minding your own business, and suddenly, out of nowhere, seemingly, this thought arises. You can see the arising of a thought. The thought was not there before. It just arises. Wow. And then if you're there, sometimes you see it, it goes away. You see a thought arises and it passes. Isn't that amazing? Normally, our life, we're just, you know, you hardly even know you're thinking. You're so busy thinking. And the thoughts just kind of come one after the other, and they seem to, is there beginning to thoughts? Well, they're just, it's endless. And sometimes there's new subjects, but it's just kind of like, you know, cascades. And so much so that some people's, the world they live in is the world of their thinking. They don't know anything else. And so, but to actually watch, you know, have the stillness of the mind, and that stillness, watch. It's quite something. It gets even better very occasionally for some people. Sometimes you can sit there very still, and you can feel a little impulse to think. Sometimes you'll feel it, say it's like a little bubble, a pressure, a bubble that kind of begins, kind of swelling in the mind. And if you're really attentive and bring attention right there, when that urge begins to happen, that urge will just fade away. And you'll never know what that thought was going to be about. It could have been the solution to your life's problems. Though the track record of your thoughts is not, probably, you know, doesn't lend itself to that conclusion. And or, you know, just the great American novel, you know, you never know what it was. It's quite something. And it kind of raises all kinds of interesting questions about the nature of thinking and what goes on in the mind before consciousness. The fact that the impulse to think seems to happen before we're aware of what the content of the thought is. Anyway, so you can watch very carefully this thing happening. So when you're at that place, we can watch the arising of a thought. Then it gives a very interesting vantage point. And that is, you could hear a sound. So. And you're aware of the sound happening in the mind. This hearing happening. And then you're aware of a thought arising. And the thought is a very simple little thought that says, the sound of a bell. That's pretty innocent, pretty basic, sound of a bell. And you can see that thought arise, you see that thought pass away. And then, later, you hear the bell again. Maybe the person hits it as it's, you know, just studied the art of bell ringing. And so just a perfect ring. So, same thought. Sound of a bell. And then there's a second thought, or kind of thought or reaction, that's pleasant. Very innocent. Sound of bell, a pleasant sound. Then another time. Sound of bell, it's pleasant. I want that bell. Now, when it was just this little thought that said sound of bell, it just kind of rose and it faded by itself very easily. But when it's sound of bell, I want that bell, suddenly there's a different energy in the thinking. There's a gripping that goes on, perhaps. There's a more energized kind of thought. And you notice that that thought and the momentum of it, what it does in the mind, the ripples it creates, it doesn't settle as quickly. The first one kind of goes, ooh. This one, I want the bell, it goes, you know, its amplitude goes up really high. It's high enough, it sounds like these squeaky speakers, you know, just shh. And then the mind is much more agitated state. And in the agitated state, it takes much longer for it to settle down again. And in fact, that I want the bell tends to bring with it other thoughts. Maybe as it fades away, if you're lucky. But what it could be is you hear the sound of the bell, it's pleasant, I want that bell. I wonder if I can buy it from IMC. They probably won't sell it. I wonder if I could change it. I wonder if I could just kind of bribe them into selling it. I wonder who I should talk to. And now, it isn't just simply the amplitude has gone up, I want that bell, but we keep jacking up the amplitude. You know, we're getting wrapped up in this concern. And if your mind is very still to begin with, you can watch that the effect that has on your psychophysical system to have those kinds of thoughts that want the bell and pursuing it and racing after it and wanting it, you know, you can watch what that does, the impact it has. If you're running around town doing 10,000 different things and wanting 10,000 different things, because that's what human beings tend to do, you're not going to notice the effect of wanting the bell. You hear a nice bell, I want that bell, you start fantasizing how to get it, and you know, if the wood is really, really coarse, and you take 100, you know, if you take, you know, a nail across it, you maybe don't even notice the scratch because it's so coarse. But if the wood had been polished really, really fine, then you see the effect of that nail across the top of the wood. So the same thing with our mind. If our mind is really busy and active, you're not going to notice the effect of things. And actually, you might think it's silly, it's so subtle, this thing. But if the mind is really still and concentrated, you'll see the effect that wanting that bell has on the mind. And so there's a world of difference between the innocent thought, or so-called innocent thought, that says, sound of bell, thought arises, and there's no momentum to it, there's no fueling it, there's no picking that thought up. Not doing anything to the thought, it just arises, it fades. There's a world difference between that and having a thought arise and then having that trigger a grasping, a holding, a reaction in the mind. The reaction in the mind of wanting that bell will feel, if you're very attentive, will feel unpleasant. You know, if you really want that bell, if you're gripping onto that bell, you also notice that it tends to create a momentum, a spin, in a sense, where that energy of the mind doesn't settle as quickly as a simple thought, sound of bell. So it takes a while for it to settle then. And depending on the strength of that wanting, it'll take longer and longer to settle that momentum of that thought pattern, that energy in the mind. Is that making sense? Karma means, the word karma means action or activity or making. And in the Buddhist understanding of karma, karma has to do with that difference. You make karma for yourself when you react in the way that begins creating momentum in the mind. When you react, and the word react is the same meaning as, you know, karma means to act. React is to act again. And when the mind is really still, you can see that karmic consequence, the momentum, what the reaction sets into place. The reaction that it's created. When the mind is very busy, it's invisible to us. We don't see it. you don't have a clue that wanting the bell has any kind of effect in the mind, any momentum in the mind. Some of these reactions in the mind create momentum which don't reveal themselves maybe for many days or many months or many years. In traditionally Buddhism, they say maybe many lifetimes. If you lie, it creates certain... Lying is a reactive movement of the mind. And so you create a certain energy then, spin, momentum, in your thought pattern, in your mind's patterns. And that spin, that momentum, will linger there, perhaps for a long time, as you're busy paying attention to other things, until something arises that where that momentum manifests itself in some way or other. It could be simply a disposition, like a habit formation. So you do something, it becomes easier to do it in the future. Or it could be that that you meditate 20 years later, and as the mind gets quieter, you reach that level of the mind where that the energy of that lying is sitting there waiting for you. That reactivity. It's like you know, maybe it's like, yeah, so. So karma has to do with this, the reactive qualities of the mind. And then the momentum, the spin, the energy that creates in our psychophysical system. The classic way of talking about karma is that karma is born through our intentional activity, by what we intend. And so the idea here is we have a thought, and then we have an intention in relation to that thought. We do something with that thought. So, and it could be we do something, we have aversion to it, we want it. It could be many things that we do. But as we do, we pick up and react, it creates momentum. As the mind gets quieter and quieter, we can see more deeply what is it that's going on. Now, when the mind is quiet, in this way I'm talking about today, maybe after a long retreat, then you'll see a place of choice. You'll see the bell arise, the sound of the bell. You hear it. You'll notice perhaps a simple thought that says, sound a bell, it's pleasant. And you'll see a thought that says, or a movement that says, I want that bell. At that point, there's a choice whether to get further onto that train, that thought, or to leave it alone. And if you see that place of choice, then you can just leave it alone and let the momentum in the mind play itself out. If you choose not to leave it alone and pick it up, then you can watch the momentum maybe get big, high, stronger and stronger until you get a headache because you really want that, for example. So there's a moment of choice, and the choice here is basically one of either going along with picking it up or leaving it alone and letting it fade away. As we get good at looking at the place of choice, the moment of choice, then we can see there's other choices we can make also besides leaving things alone or picking them up. We can actually let the mind go in new directions. Sometimes it's useful to think. So say you're sitting here and you hear the sound of the bell, and it's the person who doesn't do a very good job. You know. Sound of bell. Unpleasant. And then that person's a really lousy bell ringer. You are an awful person. They shouldn't allow that kind of person into IMC. You know, how could they? And IMC is so terrible to let people ring bells that way, and they should train people. And after a while, hopefully after a while you notice that train of thought is not very helpful. And it's creating a lot of momentum, this kind of momentum is one of tightness. So then you could just drop it. if you're good at dropping. Or you could change the direction of your thoughts and say, well, you know, let me, rather than, now that I've had all this kind of hateful thoughts about that person up there, let me think about this person a little bit. You know, actually, last week, when that person actually helped me, I had all this heavy stuff to carry from my car to the potluck, and the person actually helped me, and the person was really kind, and I know the person's had a hard week or whatever, and you know, I'd like to maybe, actually choose to start thinking about the person in such a way that it generates your goodwill for the person. Then you create a different momentum, different spin on the mind, different energy. Still creating energy in the mind. Energy that might take a while to settle. But this is a kind of energy in the mind that's much more pleasant and helpful to have in our life that we often live. So Buddhism says that there are some karmic activities, some reactions, that are helpful and some which are harmful. And it's possible to choose which things we pick up and how we act in the world and the reactions that we set in motion. When we're really still, like on retreat, still enough we can watch the beginning of a thought bubble and see it pass away, see the rising of a thought, that is a really optimal time to see that even the helpful reactions of the mind, the thoughts of the mind, interfere with the settling of the mind to the deepest levels of peace that are possible. So there has to be then a choice also to let go of even the beneficial kind of thinking that might go on. All thoughts, as you do the refining work, sanding the mind, all thoughts eventually fade away. And the reason to do that is not because we want to just dwell on some kind of peaceful mind, but by itself. But the more and more quiet or peaceful the mind gets in this way, the more it can see down, more it can see more and more deeply into the psyche, into the mind. I apologize for switching analogies so much, but if it's like the pool, you know, the pond. If it's muddy, we leave it alone. Not so we have a clear pond, but so that we can see what's at the bottom of the pond. So when the mind is really, really still, then we can see what's at the bottom of the mind. And what's at the bottom of the mind is in Buddhism is not something of tremendous beauty. What we see is we see the foundation of how the mind clings, how the mind is reactive. It has a tendency, a very strong disposition to react. And when we see that with a very clear mind, then there's a possibility of releasing that which lies at the bottom of the mind. And when that gets released, then it's beautiful. Then we have the mind's freedom. So karma is meant to be something very simple. It's meant to be an understanding of where the places of choice are we have. And in seeing that, beginning to understand how we can choose either to create healthy karma, healthy reactions and reactivity, or avoid creating reactivity, unhealthy ones or any at all sometimes. It also is supposed to be a teaching about how when you have the momentum going, once there's a lot of momentum in the mind, there's a lot of wisdom that needs to be had about simply accepting the fact that it's there. And then allowing it to just settle on its own. Give it its time. And it's very common on retreats, for example, that the first day or two of the retreats, so much of the kind of day-to-day karma that we're building up over the last days and weeks or whatever, working and living, stuff like that, kind of we run into it head-on. It's a real surprise to people to kind of sometimes to encounter that. And sometimes the first day or two of a retreat is kind of hard for people because of that. Our life's caught up to us. But then after a while that settles and we can go deeper. Oh, what do you think of that? Do you have anything you'd like to ask or any comments? Yes. No, but
I have a funny story about myself that took place right here. For the last month, a watch has gone off at the 40-minute point with this little electronic buzzer. And I found myself having a fair amount of aversion to this little beeper and watched that. My heart rate would get, I think, I wonder if that little beeper is going to go off before Hilda rings the bell. And then I found my heart rate go up a little bit, and I noticed that. I'm like, that's interesting. And then it would be hard for me to drop that during the meditation. And that was interesting. Sometimes I'd think, do I want to do something about that? Should I? And that was interesting, too. So today, while I was meditating, I said, I wonder if that little beeper will go off before Hilda rings the bell. And I just watched how I, you know, here we go. And suddenly I said, you know, I'm really grateful for that little buzzer because it's allowing me to really practice dropping. And can I drop that? And I did. And it came up a couple more times, and I dropped it, and I actually found myself feeling warm toward the little buzzer, but also that I would actually say something about it. I realized I wanted to ask this question about the buzzer, and then the buzzer didn't go off today. So... thank you for your remarkably karmic talk about me and the buzzer and watching myself.
When I was at, when we were at Palo Alto a few years ago, I remember there was this cell phone that kept going off. I thought that was kind of curious, I thought. And I guess it gives people things to practice with and, you know. Again, it's just strange they don't turn it off, but it's going off. And then at some point, at the end of the sit, or some point, I realized it was my phone.
Just a quick comment or reaction, and that is about wanting, hearing the bell and wanting the bell. It just dawned on me that, I mean, our, so much of our culture is predicated upon, you know, with all the marketing and advertising, that we want so much and trying to engender in all of us all this wanting and wanting all these bells. It just seems to me, oh my gosh, how, what chance is there for us to be a peaceful culture, you know?
You know, if we don't watch carefully, then there's all this stimulus out there that the mind reacts to and picks up all this momentum. And so, advertisement, for example, you know, the advertisers don't create the momentum, but they create the stimulus that where, you know, we get caught.
There's a book called The Artist's Way, and one of the assignments in this workbook is to take yourself out on an artist date. And you can take yourself anywhere, but you go with the mindset of just absorbing your environment and with no real purpose. And I took myself to a shopping center, and I was really struck by the difference in my whole body and my whole being there just to look, as opposed to being there with a mission to accomplish my to-do list or whatever. And it really was amazing that just that little shift of being in the same environment, I was a different person. And there wasn't that clinging. It was just to look at color, look at shape. It was quite different.
I used to get exhausted going to bookstores. And that took me a long time to realize why. But it was because I wanted so many books. I want this, I want that. Yes.
Earlier you mentioned about, you know, getting backaches during meditation. Like 3 years ago when I went on a 10-day meditation retreat, 3 days later I got really, really sick. Like, and I was meditating at home, an hour in the morning, an hour at night. And all of a sudden, from being perfectly healthy, I had a fever of 102 degrees and I was vomiting like a few times and really, really bad headache, and I don't normally get headaches. And finally, my husband suggested I go to the emergency room because it's really strange. And it just all occurred like within like an hour, just like, you know, all this stuff. And then went to see the doctor, Palo Alto Medical Foundation, and they gave me a CT scan of my brain. He said they were like symptoms of brain cancer. And he couldn't find anything. He was like, there's nothing wrong with you. And he asked me, so what happened to you? Is there anything that changed? And I said, well, I said no at first. And I'm like, well, I went on a 10-day meditation retreat, but I can't see why this could possibly happen as a result of that. And he asked me what happened in the meditation. I talked about sweeping energy. And he said, well, we can't measure energy, so we won't know. So I'm not saying that it's not from that. Anyways, it went away after about 8 or 9 hours. It just like back to normal, right? And then, okay, I was dismissed it. And just about a few months ago, I went to see an integrative medicine doctor, Stanford Hospital, and she's a Chinese medicine and an MD. And I told her about it. And she said, well, actually, that's very common, what you experienced, for people who go on long retreats, because it's kind of like a physical manifestation out of things that starts to kind of unfold and negativity coming out. But I wasn't really fully, well, I guess I had was present too. Like the change was, you know, when I went out on the street in downtown Palo Alto, I felt really sensitive to seeing homeless people. So that was one change that I felt. So what I wanted to ask was, what's your knowledge or experience of that?
Your experience, I wouldn't say it was common, common experience, but it happens enough that it doesn't surprise me. That could be there, something coming out of the retreat. It's hard to know, you know, but so I wouldn't want to weigh in. But meditation practice, especially on retreat, can for some people be a very powerful purification process. And so sometimes the powerful kind of things that we hold inside of us will come out quite dramatically. Sometimes people get nauseous. Very occasionally people will throw up. It's very occasional, but you know, it can happen. And sometimes the stuff people hold inside themselves is so ugly or so painful, so difficult, there's a physiological kind of reaction that happens as they kind of look at stuff and things come up and they're purifying things in their body. And sometimes getting fever is also a symptom that I've known people have had. It lasts for a few hours or something. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with being sick. It just seems to kind of wash through. I've known people who've gotten, occasionally I've known people who get fever-like symptoms only when they sit down to meditate. So then you think, well, you know, it's probably nothing to do with, you know, being sick. It's something going on in that process. So it really depends on what people keep inside of themselves. When I was in Burma, my teacher, the Pandita, was very fond of telling these kind of karma stories, I guess, of his monastery would get both soldiers or retired soldiers come to meditate. But also he would get guerrillas, you know, these Burmese guerrillas who were fighting the government, but also kind of, I guess, retire as guerrillas or something. And they'd come and meditate in the monastery. So he had a wide range of people come meditate. But he liked to tell the stories about these people who had been, you know, soldiers, one form or other, and what it was like for them to meditate. Also, once he told the stories of a butcher who tried to, you know, was trying to meditate, certain kind of professions. And you know, they're sitting and meditating, and they get to some block, tremendous block, and the difficulty, because this karma of their activity of killing people and torturing people, you know, weighed so heavy on their psyche that somehow they would have these tremendous upheavals as they had to kind of go through that level of their psyche. So I'm not saying that you're that kind of person, but but there can be this, you know, it can be quite a powerful process. But I wouldn't say it's common to have it that strong, but it's not unexpected. Up there.
When you were talking about getting that clarity of to the point where the mud settles in your mind and you can see into what's the bottom of your mind, I'm just wondering, you know, how many years of daily meditation before you get to a point like that? I mean, so I'm sure it's different for everybody.
Yeah, it's different for everybody.
Does that take a lifetime or?
it depends on the individual. And how they practice, and how much they practice, and depends a little bit on the weather. You know, circumstances sometimes outside of our control that come into play also. Some people seem to fall into deep states of meditation quite easily, for whatever reason. Some people it takes a long time. And then, you know, it depends a little bit how you practice. You practice diligently enough and well enough, as you know, so in a way that's effective and helpful for that process to occur. It helps if you can go in retreats periodically to make that process. I'm really struck. I'm teaching a retreat right now, a 2-week retreat, which over the years I've taught. It's really remarkable to see how people change from year to year. People only go on retreat once a year. And how over the years there's this deepening process that goes on, that you know, just from being on retreat, and I'm quite inspired by that. So I don't really know how to answer your question. It's really, the question is how long will it take you? What will it take for you to do it? Right, that's the question. And then the part of that answer then is how motivated are you? Because if a person can think it's a good idea, but there has to be you know, an adequate amount of motivation that matches who you are. And sometimes it takes tremendous motivation in order to do the work, because you have to use a lot of, you know, 50 grit sandpaper, you know, to even get to, you know, to get even close. And some people don't need much 50 grit sandpaper, you know, for whatever reason. So we don't know how long it's going to take, but it takes a lot of motivation. And so sometimes looking at motivation, what's really important. What I like to stress is that no amount of mindfulness is wasted. So it doesn't really, you know, in a sense, there's a point of view where it's from that even if a person doesn't go to that level of stillness in their practice, there's tremendous benefit from any moment of mindfulness. There's freedom to be found in any moment of mindfulness. And ideally a person would hold both at the same time. The idea that any moment of mindfulness, there's a freedom there. And if you can sustain enough of those moments of mindfulness together to create continuity, that actually also allows for a deep, a phenomenal deepening to occur too.
So once you achieve that kind of clarity, is that something that you've now achieved and you retain, or is that something that you have to continue to work at to maintain that? That level of clarity.
For most people, it's something that they dip into for a while and they come out of. So that level, you kind of watch thoughts arise and disappear. And the point is not to have that level of clarity or that level of kind of insight. The point is to use that ability of clarity to see where there is some issue that needs to be resolved, and then to resolve it, and that issue can be resolved, and then the mind gets busier again, but that issue has now been resolved. Does that make sense? That's kind of like what's that like? You know, you have a microscope that's dirty, the lens is dirty, but you need the microscope to see something, and so you clean the microscope and then you see, and then you've seen it, and then you can let the microscope get a little dirty again because you've seen. Well, I hope this was helpful. I hope that you will look at the places of choice. You don't have to be at this very refined place to find the moment of choice. There's a moment of choice even when life is really busy. How do you relate to chaos? That's a moment of choice. You relate to chaos, things are falling apart, with some degree of leaving it alone, not picking it up, not reacting to it, or do you react to it? So there's always, you can always find some place of choice. It depends on, which sandpaper you need to use. So, thank you.